Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. I'm going to be in conversation with well-known, interesting figures. Now, when it gets to the end of that conversation, don't rush off, because we have got the illustrious, wondrous psychologist Karen Cowan on hand to discuss what's been said and to give us some insight and various tips on what we can do with our mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. Our guest on episode 9 of Shed Talks is someone who's been a professional sportsman and highly successful national hunt jockey. He went on to invent the successful Jockey Cam cameras and is now an award-winning writer and director of television and film documentaries. His latest film, The Fall, has just come out, combines his two passions, film and horses. This is a first for Shed Talks because we are speaking to a man who has ridden more horses than we've had hot dinners. But he's also based in California, and that's not in Yorkshire where he comes from. Please welcome Nathan Horrocks.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Well, it's great to have you all the way from San Francisco. So that's great. Well, actually, you are a little bit in Napa Valley. You're next door to Napa, aren't you?
I am. I'm in a little town called Petaluma, which is in the Sonoma Valley. They call it the North Bay.
Well, it's going to be a really good, it's going to be a very good episode. And here we go. So you and I met through a third party, the wonderful, wondrous and extraordinary Robert Bathurst. How come you know Robert?
Well, a long story short, through my writing of the film The Fall, a gentleman called Rod Street, who is chief executive of Great British Racing, I told him about this project that I'd been working on, and it's the first time I'd been working with actors. I've made documentaries and commercials and stuff, but I've never really done any drama before, and Rod said, you know, you should speak to Robert Bathurst. And I went, isn't that the guy from Cold Feet? And, you know, he said, yeah, that's right. You know, and he's been in Downton Abbey. And I said, oh, I'd love to speak to him about it. And, you know, immediately when I managed to get in contact with Robert through Rod Street, I could tell that he was an absolute sponge for the world of horse racing. He adores this sport and adores the characteristics that go within it, you know, whether it be from the horses or the trainers or the owners, and in particular the jockeys. He was very taken with their kind of makeup, what type of people they are. And it was great to chat to him just about that, really. And then later on, he would chat to me about what this project was about, how I'd like to involve him. And, you know, as we went down the line, he would then say, you know, look, I think I can help develop these characters, because, you know, it's you know, The Fall is a short, it's a 21 minute long film.
Yeah.
And, you know, with these types of projects, you've got to have some sort of character base in there. And Robert was vital in helping me, you know, develop that idea.
Great. So, Nathan, as stated, great to have you on Shed Talks. I don't want to be the person giving all the game away or being a killjoy or anything like that, but it seems to me, having been acquainted with your whole story, that you were handed quite a hand of bad cards to begin your life with. I mean, some might say it's a set of jigsaw pieces, a set of traumatic jigsaw pieces that all happened to you in the first few years of your life. And you know, kicking that off just before you were born, tragically, your sister drowned in a pond in the garden. Awful, awful. The trauma of that led your parents to obviously, you know, fight, whatever, but in the end, they separated and divorced, and your mother left. Your father took you to Kenya for the first few years of your life, away from where you've been born in Yorkshire. And, you know, obviously it had a big effect on your father, the whole thing. He became a drinker and had more effects on you and communications with your mother, where it was all, you know, terrible, terrible, terrible guilt. Came back to England, aged 4 or 5, into a deeply Yorkshire school, Wensleydale, I think it was. And, you know, you were a very terrified child. You didn't know what was going on. Learning difficulties, bullied, awful. You know, really, really tough stuff. Really tough stuff. And then into your teens, and tragically, your other sister became very ill with anorexia. So all in all, and I'm not trying to load this talk, but you had a really poor start. Maybe you agree, maybe you don't. What do you think?
People look at my life and say I've had a really tough journey here. Particularly, I think I've had a really good journey, other than a couple of little blips along the way, a couple of obstacles.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny how some people look at my life and say it's been quite tragic, but I feel really lucky, I'll be honest with you, with the life that I've had.
Right. Well, that's a good way to look at it. You know, we want to get to the riding side of things. And your father had been a jockey, and that there was sort of horse racing in the family. I think you had a sort of an epiphany, didn't you, watching a Breeders' Cup race with your dad on a sofa, and you going, hold on a minute, that's a Razzie. Is it a Razzie was the horse?
A Razzie, yeah. The horse was called a Razzie. And I remember it was 1991, and I'd just turned 16, just left school with zero qualifications, having no idea what I was going to do. And a European horse called a Razzie went and won the juvenile sprint in America. And I think it was the razzmatazz of the American commentary and just what America kind of brought to the, you know, to the show. I thought, oh, wow, you know, this really, you know, kind of stuck with me. And I just remember the horse weaving through all the, you know, the rest of the field and then going off and winning. You know, it was like a scene from a movie, you know. And that really stuck with me. And then it kind of gave me the, you know, the idea that, you know, actually, this actually looks like something I could do. My dad was a jockey. There's no reason why I can't be. And that's what I did. You know, the next day, I remember going down to one of the local stables. I think there's something like 10 different training yards in Midland. It's a training centre for racehorses. And I remember going to George Moore's, knocking on the door and saying, can I have a job?
Brilliant. And that was like that was you off and running. The next thing was that you became a professional jockey.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, there's a certain journey to becoming a jockey. You know, you start off as a, you know, as an apprentice, and you go off to the British Racing School in Newmarket. There's another one in the north of England, the Northern Racing College, and you have to, you know, show that your skill set, and then you're able to get an apprentice or a what's called a conditional jockey's license. And so that's how I started out, really, was as a conditional jockey, you know, riding over the jumps. And, you know, I think I rode over just over 60 winners. I mean, I you know, really, I was not a successful jockey in regards to the amount of winners that I rode. You know, I did it for 10 years. You know, I was a professional sportsman. I was, you know, was paid to do it. So one thing I did enjoy about that whole journey was learning the connection with, you know, with horses, and
yes,
learning how to ride them and communicate with them. But also learning to communicate myself, because I've never been a good communicator till I started being a jockey. I had to learn that pretty fast, communicating how to assess a race with a trainer or an owner. So that's one thing I really had to learn pretty quick on my feet.
Yeah, no, got you. And I mean, I can understand the physical side of it. I mean, it's kind of weird. I mean, this is perhaps a silly thing to say, but when you are quite not tiny, but you know, you're on the smaller side and lighter side, and I look at the size of some of those horses, you know, to me, I'm thinking, my God, you know, that's going to be very tricky indeed. And that probably sounds totally crass, but
not at all. I mean, to be honest with you, I would expect the opposite. You know, some people watch racing and you know, their thoughts of it is it looks quite easy because all the horse is doing all the work. You know, a jockey's you know, they say all the jockey does is sit on the horse, but you know, it would be very, very difficult for someone just to even, you know, go 100 yards standing on 6 inches of carbon Kevlar, you know, balancing on a half ton of horse that's you know, that's basically it's a balloon full of air that you're trying to control, you know, that's losing air. And it's that's the only way I can kind of describe it, really. And it's that thing of communicating through your fingertips and through your hands and through your voice, you know, because you want this animal to save its energy towards the end of the race. And racehorses are flight animals, and what they're trying to do is they're trying to use that energy early on in the race, and you wanting them to use that at the latter end of the race. And that's a quite difficult thing to do. And all horses are different. They're like humans. Some are lazy, some are nervous, you know, some are excited, you know, so you've got to try and communicate in the best way to get the best out of this horse. And I think that's a skill set that, you know, the general public don't understand, because when we watch horse racing, it's from that big wide, you know, angle, and you can't really see the skill set of what these human and equine athletes are actually trying to achieve. And I've kind of been chasing that communication thing all my life to try and show people outside the sport, you know, what it feels and you know, and what it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of fascinating thing, and what I get is the communication with you and the horse and the bond of that, and I'm sure someone like me could over romanticize that. But I mean, you know, a lot of people don't understand what being a jockey is about, you know, apart from what we've just discussed. I mean, there is the element of, hello, I'm the trainer, and I'm the owner, and there's the crowd, and there's the social media, and here's the this. I mean, you know, I mean, I know it was quite tricky for you on various occasions, and it really began to affect you. I mean, maybe tell us what it's like, because I don't think people know. You know, they see pictures of someone in a weighing room or something, but it's about it.
Yeah, you know, I've had many, you know, a strong conversation with the press sometimes when they've tried to interview a jockey after a beaten ride, or you know, they've been beaten on a favourite in a big race or something, and you know, they complain that jockeys can be a bit defensive and miserable. And I remember saying this to a member of the press once. I said, you know, do you get angry when you're hungry? And he said, well, yeah. And I said, well, imagine waking up like that every day of your working life, because we're constantly trying to beat the scales, you know.
Yeah.
As evolution's gone on, people are getting bigger, but the weights haven't changed. So we're constantly trying to beat the scales. There's a huge amount of travelling involved. It's not a team sport in any way, shape or form. You know, jockeys are freelancers, so they're, you know, they're self-employed. So you're constantly trying not to burn any bridges. You've got to make sure that these relationships carry on, because if they start declining, that's when you lose a ride. And there's at least 10, 15 guys behind you ready to take your place. Although, you know, this is the weird thing about being a jockey, you know, the safe haven really is the jockey's changing room, you know, because there's that camaraderie, because we're all, every time we go out there, we're risking our necks.
Yeah.
You know, it only takes one fall and we could be, you know, badly hurt and never walking or riding again. Or, you know, we've had deaths, you know, it is a dangerous sport. And there's that always in the back of your mind sometimes. I mean, some guys are great at putting that out of their minds completely. But some can't do that, you know, they're human beings, you know, they, you know, they struggle with that. So there's many different elements to being a jockey, compared to other sports that I think, they battle with, and that can then take its toll on your, you know, just on your body, but also on your mental side of things as well.
Yeah, presumably now, you know, what's going on now is you have social media. So, you know, you're supposed to win a race, and you come second, lots of people, you know, are not interested. They're only interested in their money in their pocket. and they're going to give you a hard time, I guess.
Well, that's it, you know, and for the people listening that have no idea about horse racing, you know, a successful jockey will run around about a 15% strike rate, which sounds awful, doesn't it? You know, if it was a football team that was running at a 15%, you know, win strike rate, the team would be dissolved, wouldn't it? You know what I mean? So it's you know, jockeys are constantly getting beaten. You know, they don't win a lot of the times. You know, they're constantly getting beaten, and that does take its toll on you. And, you know, my riding days, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, social media wasn't a thing. You know, yes, I'd have the odd bit of a verbal abuse from somebody in the crowd.
Yeah.
But with social media these days, we've opened the floodgates to a lot of abuse. And that's one thing I've tackled in this film, The Fall, is the amount of abuse they get, but also how venomous this abuse can be, you know, the evil things that people will say to someone. I just know they wouldn't say that in real life, but because they're on this platform, they can, you know, they can do that.
Yeah, well, that's going on all the time, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's in all walks of life as well, Jeremy, isn't it? You know what I mean? I'm not just saying it's horse racing. It's in all walks of life through politicians and whatever, but you've seen it in sport in general because there's a result. In sport, it's something that's really, really captured everybody now. And it's, you know, people are constantly giving athletes abuse because of a result, really. And I think, you know, social media platforms really need to be held accountable for this, really.
Well, and also people need to, you know, people also need to adjust their behaviour. I guess that the interesting thing is that, you know, I have a sort of slightly skewed view of jockeys in the sense I was thought they were retained by trainers, you know, on an annual basis, and it was all very jolly nice and everyone was very, very nice. But actually there are quite a lot of parallels, and I think we touched on this when we first met. There are quite a lot of parallels to actors. You know, audition, thank you, goodbye, thank you, goodbye. And that whole idea of, you know, being rejected. I mean, actors are amazing. I couldn't do that. But there is that element in your thing that in being a jockey in the self-esteem department, getting a kicking. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's you know, it's constant rejection. You know, not just going to the racetrack, you're putting a lot of hours in before going to the races, you know, exercising these horses. And there's a thing called schooling them, you know, where you practice over the jumps or you're giving them a gallop, you know, so you're letting the trainer know what distance this horse should run over, what ground it should run over, what type of race would suit this, you know, what grade. You know, this horse should be running in. So you're giving a lot of this information away. So you're spending a lot of time doing that, and then you don't get the ride. It's given to one of the top jocks. You know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
That can be soul destroying. You know, but because you've got to climb that ladder in
yeah.
somewhere. You're starting at zero, and you've got to climb the ladder. And like all sports, I understand that. But there's just a lot of times when you're putting a lot of work in and not getting a lot out of it. And that can take its toll, like I was saying earlier.
Yeah.
You know, it can be a tough old life.
It sounds like it did with you in terms of, you know, the sleep department going wrong and feeling sort of mildly crummy, to put it mildly. And what happened?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, with my riding days, you know, it did take its toll, and the person I was riding for, the trainer I was riding for at the time, probably wasn't the best man manager you know, you could have worked for. He thought motivation came from, you know, shouting at you or mind manipulation in some way.
Yeah.
I remember I rode down at Fakenham, and I remember riding, I think I had four rides for this trainer that I was employed by. And they all got beaten. And the journey home was, he didn't speak to me in the 4 hours driving home. This was after the bollockings I got from, you know, from each ride that I rode. But the radio was on full blast, so we couldn't speak to each other. And you know, I was a 21-year-old, you know, still a child, really, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And just not knowing how to deal with this, really, you know. And I remember a week later, I rode a horse for him in a race, and you know, the horse finished second. I remember the ground not being good for the horse because he likes fast ground, because he's the type of horse that loves the firm ground, and it was soft ground that day. And I remember the horse getting beaten, and this trainer just tore shreds off me in the second enclosure in front of the owners and everybody else. And I kind of took it quite well. I could still feel myself, like, you know, feeling the anxiety of, you know, wanting to tell him to F off, you know. And then he followed me into the changing rooms in front of all the other jockeys and the clerk of the scales. This is the area where jockeys weigh out.
Yeah.
And I remember him just absolutely just handing it to me, showing me how I should be pushing a horse. And it just felt the humiliation I felt. I just, like, wanted the hole to open up and just swallow me up. And, you know, I remember our stable jockey at the time, you know, the one that was employed by the same gentleman, telling me, you know, that was completely bang out of order how he acted.
Yeah.
Well, a week later, I just decided that I just didn't want to do this anymore. You know, I wanted to do something else. And that's where my transition of going from being a, you know, professional jockey and then wanting to be a filmmaker kind of started, really. And I quit a week later.
Yeah, no, I've got that. But it must have been stuff rumbling inside you, as it were, just in the mental health department, or maybe you just overrode it without any pun.
No, I know what you mean. It's like I say, it was something that was, you know, the dieting, and, you know, I had a lot of falls, you know, I'd been concussed, I think something like 20 times. And... you know, it just wore me down, and I just thought there's just more to life than doing this. You know, some people are built for being that type of sports person, and I just wasn't. And thankfully, I got out when I did. But things like that, you know, the pressures of it all was building up, and I wasn't doing anything about it. And I think that's the reason why I've kind of made the fall, really. And it's great nowadays that where we talk about mental health, where men will speak about this more. You know, women suffer with mental health as well, but being a British man, being brought up in North Yorkshire, in this sport of, you know, jump jockeys are tough, you know, so there's all these elements of having to be tough and having to get on with it and having to bury all this stuff took its toll later on in life. And then you know, if you don't do anything about it, one day you wake up and it's just going to go snap. And that's kind of where it was leading me.
Yeah, I can see that. And I know that. And I think at the same time, and I hate to raise this, but I think it was, you know, around this time that your other sister had serious problems.
She did. Yeah. She'd had a tricky relationship with this guy who I actually went to school with. And I don't know what went on, but for some reason that their breakup led her down the path of becoming anorexic. And what was painful for me to see, not experience really, but for me to see, was, you know, the decline in her health going down rapidly. And my dad and my, you know, my stepmother at the time, you know, who's still with my dad, trying to make her better. And I think what the hard thing was I felt really, really angry at her for the torment that she was causing, not the torment, sorry, the torture really that she was causing my dad, because he'd already lost one daughter.
Yeah.
And I could just see him declining. And I just had a lot of anger towards her, of why she was doing this. Now, at the time, that was probably a bit selfish, and you know, I wasn't thinking of how she was feeling, because, you know, anorexia is another part of mental health. You know, it's a disease. You know, it's something that she was battling with, and unfortunately, she you know, after a couple of years of this, she just didn't survive it. And you know, I remember I was on Gallops in middle of North Yorkshire, and I got the phone call, you know, my dad saying, you know, Nathie, you better come home. And, you know, I remember just putting the horse in the stable and getting in the car and getting home, because I could just tell there was something wrong. And I remember walking in and just seeing my dad just broken, you know, absolutely broken. You know, he'd lost another baby, you know, that really, hurts when you see your father like that, you know. And that was really, it was really, really tough to experience. And then, you know, just that anger that I had against her for, you know, for doing that, really kind of, I don't know, it left a real chip on my shoulder. Like, I was angry at the world. Like, you know, I'm not a religious person at all because of this. You know, I see why people are religious, but for some reason, you know, if there is a God, why would he do this to this good guy, you know, and this, you know, and this lovely person, you know? And that's what, that it just left me with a lot of anger issues and left a real chip on my shoulder, which I would then, you know, carry for the next 10 years. And it just didn't help me become a good, I didn't feel like a good person, really.
Yeah. No, I mean, I understand. I think it's a really honest response about being angry with her when tragically she died. But I understand it when you look at what happened. And I'm sure all of that came up later. Absolutely certain about it. Speeding on, well, not speeding on, but we're just moving on, that you left the world of being a jockey and you went to work as an on-course executive with the wondrous Betfair. And that kept you in touch with horses, because to me it's really obvious, knowing your story, horses have been your whole salvation and everything in many ways. But what happened was that I think halfway through this point you got married and your wife was a photographer, and I think she sort of unlocked a couple of locks in terms of you being creative. And it was then that you also watched something on the telly, which was a short film on Channel 4, Dark Side of the Lens, and that was inspirational. Your wife was inspirational. Over to you.
Yeah, I know, it's great that narrative gets us to where we've got to now, really. It's you know, I moved from Midland, North Yorkshire, funny enough, and then taking that job for Betfair. But what that job from Betfair, and you know, we'll talk about fate later, because it's a very interesting story about fate. I'm a big believer in it, and I just think certain things happen for a reason. And the job I got for Betfair, they said, look, I think you'd be best placed you know, to do your job down in Lambourne. Lambourne's another big training centre in the UK. But what blew my mind was that's where my mum lives. It was just so bizarre. And I'm like, you know, all of the places they wanted to, you know, I wanted me to be positioned. They wanted me positioned in Lambourne in the southwest.
Quite a distance from Yorkshire.
Yeah, you know, and it was great, you know. All of a sudden I was close to, you know, living close to my mum, you know. I'd obviously been visiting her over the years and stuff, but it was a great way to help cement that relationship more and be around her a little bit more. So that moving to Lambourne just after marrying Steph was great. And Steph, who was, like you just said earlier, was a photographer. I've always been fascinated by imagery, always been a huge fan of films, but never knew the process, you know, coming from where I came from in, you know, this little working class place in North Yorkshire. Film school isn't on the horizon. Yeah. You know, when you go to your careers officer, they don't really say, you know, the arts are where you should be going. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, it's, you know, you either become a builder, you know, a mechanic, or, you know, and looking at all the horse racing industry was around the corner, you know, so that's the route I went down. But lucky enough, you know, Steph would unlock this thing in me that was this creative side. And I remember coming home from the pub one night. For you music fans out there, I'm sure you know of this guy, Ben Howard. Well, his bass player is called Mickey Smith, and he made this film called Dark Side of the Lens. And Channel 4 had done a series of short films, and this one was to do with sports and extreme sports. So it immediately was something I wanted to watch. And basically it's a film about his love of surf photography, and it's a love letter to the world that he's in and the passion that he has for this sport and the people around it. You can find it on YouTube, Dark Side of the Lens. It's definitely worth watching, because
where's it shot?
I think it's shot in Cornwall, where he's from. I remember the part of the poem that he says, you know, if I only scrape a living, at least it's a living worth scraping. And it just stuck with me that it was like, you know, follow the stuff that you want to do. And in 2010, you know, YouTube was relatively still quite new, But there was a lot of this world of people were just going out there and making stuff themselves. And that was the permission. You know, seeing that film was the permission, because I read up about this guy and said he shot it himself. And I'm like, well, I can do that. And I think it's like anything, you know, it's like any business that you start in life, and especially nowadays, because when you've got the internet, you can literally start your own company by owning a laptop and having the internet.
Yeah.
It was that switch. It was that permission to go and do it yourself. So I immediately went out the next day, bought a camera, and then started learning how to film horses. And, you know, later on, you know, in 2012, I would then set up a company with my two business partners, Dave James and Sam Fleet, Equine Productions, to try and help promote the sport that I'm in love with. So I wanted to tell my story of what I've seen behind the scenes. And that's kind of where we got to, really.
I think that's brilliant, isn't it? Now, let's just get to this next bit. You knew Oliver Sherwood, a really top trainer in the racing business.
Yeah, he's a top trainer that's still based in Lambourne. So the reason, you know, when I went to Lambourne, I wanted to still get my horse fix. And a friend of mine was his assistant trainer, said, oh, you know, just come and ride out in the morning, ride one before you go off to work, you know. And that's why, you know, the connection with Oliver was there, really.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, keep going, because we're now revealing. revealing a pretty interesting.
Yeah, so revealing what you're, I know where you're, the road you're trying to take me down, Jeremy, was the me riding out for Oliver.
Yeah.
Led me to meeting a horse called Many Clouds, who most racing fans will know won the 2015 Grand National. And at the time when I first moved to Lambourne, I was riding what we call a senior horse, a horse that was around about 10 to 12 years old. And he was the nice, gentle giant that would look after me, that was, you know, just going in there to ride out, you know, as to get my horse fixed, basically. But he got retired, unfortunately. And Oliver said, well, we'll have to find you something else to ride. And he said, there's that big bay gelding in the corner that won last Saturday. You can ride him from now on. And that ended up being the horse called Many Clouds, who was owned by an absolute superstar and a real supporter of National Hunt Racing in the UK, a guy called Trevor Hemmings, who actually owned Blackpool Tower.
Right.
And, you know, people are known from, you know, owning Centre Parks and things like that. So
right.
He was a real, real gent, this guy. And I actually rode for him as a jockey, but could never ride him a winner. So you can see how my decline of being a jockey started. But lucky enough for me, I was introduced to Many Clouds. And I wasn't, you know, wasn't aware of how great he was going to end up being. But I remember sitting on him that morning and remember saying to Oliver, this is probably one of the best horses I've ever sat on, you know.
Really? And, you knew?
Yeah, and he was like, you know, what he just had a big engine, you know, and had a real desire to win, really. But one thing Clouds had that some horses suffer from, he's really nervous. And in particularly when he was in his stable. So I remember, having to do a lot of work with him in the stable to get him, have him not being so nervous around people. So it's amazing, really, that he ended up becoming this, you know, this horse that was adored by the public, and the public would come and visit him. And, the scenes when he won the Grand National that, we walked him down to the village of Lambourne. And I think there was something like 20,000 people all turned up to come and, you know, congratulate Oliver and the horse. You know, you can see outside the pub in Lambourne, there was all these people patting him. And I was thinking, God, you know, knowing this horse, coming, knowing where he's came from, you know, this nervous baby to this animal that's just stood, you know, relaxed in front of all these people. And he was just a real inspiration to me, really, because he was watching his racing style. You know, he was just, he never quit. He was just, he wore his heart, you know, wore his heart on his sleeve. He was such a, you know, Oliver, we would say this, you know, he'd run through a brick wall for you, you know, and that was a great way of describing him. You know, you would take him to war. He was a real warrior. And that's what one thing I really, really respected about, you know, being around him.
Did he like you?
I think he did. Yes. I mean, there was only a few people that rode him, and he used to be, you know, this might not make any sense to some of the listeners, but he used to be really strong. You know, he used to pull my arms out. He used to want to try and run off with me, and and to try and to get him what we call switching off, to relax, was quite hard sometimes, because he just wanted to gallop all the time and run off with you. And that was quite hard to get him to do that. But for some reason, you know, 8 times out of 10, I could get him to, you know, to switch off and relax. But there was them two times when Oliver would be, you know, saying to me at the top of the gallop, "What happened there?" And I was like, "Well, I just couldn't stop him, you know." So, you know, some days he'd make his own mind up and decide to, you know, run off with me. But I had a real rapport with him and a great relationship with him. I'm so thankful that he came into my life, because it was a real joy going into the Olivers and riding him out. And then he ended up being a big part of us developing the jockey cam, which is, you know, which is the reason why I'm now here in the US. You know, we were developing the camera, and when I was wearing the camera, developing it, it was on him.
And that was that's a camera that goes on the helmet.
That's right. It's a camera that goes on the jockey's helmet and is used live, you know, a bit like we've seen with Formula One over the last 20 years. You know, the onboard camera just shows you so much. And we were never able to do that back in the day in horse racing, because, you know, the cameras were too big, they were too heavy, you know, so there was a safety side to it. So we developed a camera that was safety approved by the British Horse Racing Authority and the helmet companies, and we developed this camera so you could actually see the point of view of the jockey from the race. You know, something that I would been keen to do for many years, because, like I said earlier in the in our talk, it looks very easy to see what jockeys are doing, you know, from that big wide angle. But now I can put the audience actually in the saddle, and they can see how difficult it can be. You know, the gaps they've got to go through, and the skill from the equine and the human athlete. And we were lucky that year, that 2015, when Many Clouds won the Grand National, that was us launching Jockey Cam with Channel 4. And I mean, what a launch it was. You know, it's we had it on the winner of the Grand National. It was just absolutely amazing. What a day that was. It was 2015 was a very, very weird year for me.
Yes, well, I'm going to come on to that. 2015 for you in this respect was tick, 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 you know, cherry, cherry, cherry. But there was a sad part of it, which was that it didn't work out with your wife.
No, and it was a real shock to me. I mean, you know, one thing that was definitely happening was, you know, Equine Productions was taken off, and I was getting busy with that, and I was still working for Betfair at the time. And I remember when I had to quit Betfair, because obviously to make the company grow and Jockey Cam grow, I had to, you know, give 100% to it. But I was probably spreading myself. A lot of marriages have suffered from this. I'm spreading myself far too thinly. And and the marriage between me and Steph was slowly going downhill. However, that didn't seem, you know, as it's happening in front of my eyes. You know, everything seemed fine. I was probably, you know, pardon the pun, but blinkered. Running in this one direction of trying to be successful. And, you know, unfortunately, the marriage ended in November 2015. And I remember Steph sitting on the couch and saying, you know, I'm leaving you, and being literally being hit by a baseball bat. I just couldn't believe it, because he just had no, there was no, there was just no signs of this, why it was going to end and why it was going wrong. But you know, one of the big things that really did hinder our marriage, and I kind of took it for granted really, was the fact that she wanted children and I didn't really, and that was a really, really tough thing for her to kind of deal with. And you know, if one person's not wanting children and the other one is, that you know, you could become to a bit of a stalemate really, don't you? And yeah. That was a real tough thing, and I've never wanted children.
Do you mind me asking why not?
Well, no, I don't mind really, because you know, it's, you know, that, you know, I'm here today, sat here today with a stepdaughter of 13 years old, and I for me, it's been a joy having her, but she's not my child. You know, I haven't brought her into the world. I can inspire other children and her, and you know, and be good to them, but you know, if I was to bring a child into this world, and this is my sticking point, if I was to bring a child into this world and that child ended up going through some of the stuff that I've gone through, That's my fault. You know, I've done that to that child. And that's always the one thing that's stopped me wanting to have children, really, is the fact that, you know, you're the one that's brought them into this world. And now, you know, this world is really hard to live in sometimes. It's really, really hard. And I was just too frightened of doing that to a child, really.
Right, right. Even though all the things that had happened to you had happened to you, it wouldn't have been things that you'd done.
No, but I just suppose it's just my, I suppose I'm, you know, I'm very, very sensitive, you know, and sensitive to, you know, energy, or whether it be, you know, stuff I hear on the news or whatever. And it just really affects me. And I'm worried that, you know, if I was ever to have a child, I would, you know, I would pass that on to them, you know. So it's a real fear of mine, really.
Yeah.
But I've never had the, you know, I've never had the idea of not being around children. All my friends have children, you know, and it's
no.
I get to be, you know, cool Uncle Nathan rather than being dad, you know. Whereas at the moment, like I say, I'm having, you know, I've got a 13-year-old stepdaughter, and you know, it's been great having her and learning the parental, you know, process with her. But what's cool about that is you know, if she's, because she does have struggles, you know, like all kids do.
Yeah.
But I can just be an inspiring side of that rather than being, you know, it's my fault that you're here having this, having these issues, you know.
Okay. Okay. Got that.
I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does.
I mean, it does in my head anyway.
No, it does. It's, you know, well, it's a long conversation. Now, we now come to a rather, well, I don't know what to say. It was obviously a very, very sad point for you in January 2017 at Cheltenham with Money Clouds. And that must have been absolutely terrible. Can you talk us through what happened and what happened to you after that?
Yeah, no, I, you know, not long after my divorce, I kind of put a lot of my energy, well, all my energy then into Equine Productions and, you know, and Many Clouds, because all of a sudden he'd been, you know, become this, you know, Grand National winning horse, and obviously had a lot of ability, and he was going for his second Grand National. And I wanted to make sure I was available to ride him when I could. And, you know, I've really felt part of that team, really, at Oliver Sherwood's. And, you know, all my energy was kind of put into him, you know, because I was going through a really, really tough time, because, you know, when Steph left, it was a real blow, and I wasn't sure how to kind of deal with it, really. And leading up to 2017, Many Clouds were running a prep race, which is at Cheltenham, and he ended up winning this race and ended up beating a really good horse called Thistlecrack in the race. It was a much better horse than Many Clouds, but it was just detriment to him just being such a battler, and you know, beat Thistlecrack a short head at Cheltenham. But unfortunately, you know, this happens on a racetrack, and you know, yes, I question myself, why do we do this? You know, we love all these animals, we care for these animals, but we're willing to risk them sometimes, you know. And it's he then collapsed and died after not long after that race on the racetrack. And it was a weird moment, because obviously we weren't expecting him to win the race. It was just a, you know, a prep race. Obviously we thought he deserved to run in it. But I remember somebody tapping me on the shoulder and just saying, you know, because I was watching the big screen at the time in the paddock, and someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, he's gone down. And I remember just sprinting up the track to try and, you know, to see where he is. And the first person I bumped into was my ex-wife, Steph, with you know, who was actually walking back with CJ, Chris Jordan, who looks after the horse, and she just said, he's gone, you know. And I just didn't know what she was talking about, you know. It was bizarre, you know. I it was such a shock, because I hadn't really known what had happened. And for some reason, I remember just ignoring her. It was such a weird thing to do, but I remember ignoring her and carried on running up the track. And Oliver Sherwood, who the trainer, was walking back towards me, and I remember him saying, you know, he's dead, he's, you know, he's gone. And then, and I was just absolutely devastated. I just couldn't believe it. And Oliver was, you know, was just in bits, you know. You know, I remember just like hugging him and just saying, I'm so sorry. And, but I wanted to see, you know, I wanted to see Clouds. I wanted to go up and, you know, and see him. So, you know, when a horse is either injured or when a jockey goes down, they put the screens round, to, you know, to give them privacy. And also to, you know, protect the public from what's, you know, what's going on behind the screens, really. And, I remember getting up there, and one of my good friends actually was clerk of the course, Aintree, was working at Cheltenham that day, and she said, do you want to see him? And I said, I do, yeah. So I remember going in, and there he, you know, there he was, you know, laid on the floor, and I just all I could do was just run down, pick his head up and put his, you know, his head on my lap. And you know, it was a real tough day, that, because you know, all of a sudden, you know, I know it sounds weird because he's a horse, but one of my best mates, you know, and it was just really hard to say goodbye that day. And it felt like I just didn't have anything else to kind of work towards, you know, because I kind of put all my energy into him, really. And
someone had pulled your plug out.
Yeah, it was like all the wind that I had in my sails had gone, and yeah. I'm just sat in the water, going nowhere. And it just seemed like, you know, land seemed so far away. And and, you know, it was a real, real hard blow to me. And I just, on a real decline after that, you know, started, you know, drinking a lot. And, you know, just not because, you know, like I said earlier, I had a chip on my shoulder, and that chip became very, very, very heavy, unfortunately.
And you're clearly going into a depression, and, you know, sleep, you know, insomnia and stuff like that.
I did, yeah. I couldn't sleep. I was really struggling with my place in the world.
Yes.
I was thinking, you know, I was when I was in the public, I was this happy chappy, you know, this constant, you know, always smiling and always trying to give help to, you know, I've always had this thing where I want to help people. And, you know, sometimes that took its toll on me, because I would always put my energy into other things other than my own self, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing after another, I would constantly use up that energy on everybody else. And the lack of sleep, the drinking, the self-doubt of in my place in the world, you know, why am I here, which we all ask ourselves, but, you know, we do it all the time, just led me down this really, really dark path. And you know, just one evening, you know, come home drunk, and I'd thought this many times, like, I just want to fall asleep and not wake up tomorrow.
Yeah,
I remember thinking this, you know, years earlier, you know, why do people attempt or you know, try to take their lives? And I could never understand it. How could you ever be in a place that's that dark, and why would you do that to your family, you know? But when you're in that mindset, you feel like you're a burden. You feel as though that people will be better off without you in the world. Yeah, do you know what I mean? And I don't know why I was thinking that. I just was thinking that, and I was just tired, and I just had enough, and I just didn't want to be around anymore. And I remember just taking a load of sleeping pills and drinking a bottle of gin, and just hoping for the best, you know. And just remember the next, you know, whatever it was, hours or what, I can't remember the time scale, but I remember throwing up, and a light switch went off in my brain of like, what the F am I doing? You know, I need help. I need help. Like, how the hell do I get help? And then that next few weeks, I would be speaking to professionals about how I can get this thing out of me. I needed to get rid of this thought in my head that, you know, how could I do that to my parents? Give them another dead child. And that kind of led its way to me getting therapy, really.
So the therapy had started, because I got my timeline mixed up, because you went on to make a documentary about Emily Clouds.
I did. Yeah, sorry. And yeah, you're right. It was not long after Clouds had passed, and I wanted to kind of make this this documentary about his life and the people around him, in particular the people around him. Oliver and Tanya Sherwood. Oliver Sherwood was the trainer, and Tanya's his wife.
Yeah.
And then Chris Jordan, who's his groom, who was a massive part in Clouds getting all this confidence and becoming a champion. But also there was other elements of his journey, and I wanted to tell that. So I created a film, you know, to celebrate that, really. And we entered it in a film festival and in New York, and it ended up winning Best International Director. And I remember us picking, you know, collecting the award, and you know, it was what was great about that was it wasn't in front of a racing audience.
Yeah.
It was a non-racing audience, and it was great for them to see the love and the care and the celebration around this amazing athlete.
Yeah.
You know, which he is, you know, he was an amazing athlete, the Many Clouds. And I remember going into the, you know, the bathroom and just and collapsing, really. I remember my legs giving way and not being able to get off the ground. And it was, I'd never had that before. I'd heard people say this to me before about, you know, having these moments, you know, listening to audiobooks or whatever it was, you know, that I'd heard about this thing, you know, where someone just literally falls down and they can't get up. And I remember having this moment, and I remember thinking, all those people are outside, someone's going to come in here in a minute, and you have got to get off the floor. You have to get off the ground. And I remember just physically just trying to climb up the wall and just physically get on my feet. And I remember getting onto my feet and getting outside the room. And I think that was that thing of, what is wrong with me? Why, you know, yeah. What is going on with my brain? Why am I feeling like this? And, you know, and then later on, you know, it wasn't long after that that I attempted to take my life.
Right. And so was it something that you could talk about to your mum, to a mate, or was it something you just knew, I'm going to have to find somebody, you know, a therapist? You know, did you know in yourself? I mean, because some people have no idea what to do, you know.
Well, you know, there is a stigma towards mental health, and definitely in men, definitely in British men, and hugely in men coming from working class backgrounds, there's that attitude, get on with it, you know, stop being so soft and, yeah, you know, stop being so sensitive. I remember being told that a million times, stop being so sensitive. And so I tried, you know, I was trying to bury it and not do anything with it. But once I woke up that, you know, that day from what happened, it frightened me enough to do something about it. So I, you know, went online and I looked for, you know, to get help for therapy. Now, there are places in the racing circles, you know, in the horse racing world to get this help. But I didn't want anybody to know about this. I didn't tell anybody. I was frightened to tell people. I didn't want them to think, you know, I don't know whether I was, I didn't want them to know there was anything wrong with me.
Yeah.
I was embarrassed by it all, you know? And like I said earlier, you know, you get to a point where you snap. And I found a counsellor. The first one I went to, we just didn't really click. But the second one I went to, her name was Claire, and we just clicked. And she would scrape away at my life, digging for these things that would unearth what was going on with me, and, you know, my sister's deaths, my breakup with my parents, this world that I've been living in was definitely an element to me getting to this point of crashing, basically. And it's funny, when I say scraping, I don't mean in the way like, you know,
no.
The therapy, you know, it's not like she's trying to cut away at this stuff. It's a delicate thing where she's like, it's like an archaeologist
peeling an onion.
Yeah, peeling or like an archaeologist trying to find a bone. It's like, you know, you're just slowly taking the dirt away to find this thing that's underneath it, because it's so delicate.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what it felt like, really, for me. And she did a wondrous job of helping me get through that. And, you know, I'm thankful for her to for helping me get through this whole this whole thing that I still struggle with every now and again, but I've been now given the tools to deal with these things. And but the wondrous, wondrous, wondrous thing that happened to me in 2018 was meeting the, you know, the you know, my lifesaver. You know, she is a life jacket, is Amanda, my wife. I mean, you know, she's just been there for me. And she was the first, one of the first people I told this to, you know, this story. I remember telling her that I did this, you know, very early on when I was meeting. And, you know, I think that was the whole thing, is sharing this.
Yes.
Thing that was happening to me, which we all need to do, which has led me onto the film. And
honesty, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just honesty. I think it's talking about it and not being frightened, and, you know, talking to other people about it. Since having therapy, they're like, yeah, well, you know, I've struggled. Oh, really? Did you? Yeah, you know, it's that whole thing. You know, we all struggle. Not all of us get to the point where I got to. Some do, and they're not with us anymore. And, you know, it's that whole thing. We just need to start that conversation and chat about where we are, and not be frightened to say that, you know, I'm struggling.
Just one question before we go on. I mean, when you saw Claire, the therapist, how long did that take, and how many? I'm just interested for people to know, you know. Because sometimes when people see therapists, they go, if you're Woody Allen, you did it for 68 years. But, you know, what was that for you? Was it 3 months, 6 months? Was it?
It was about a year. Yeah, just short of a year. And she would, you know, she would constantly ask me to start writing these thoughts rather than doing something about these thoughts. You know, write them, these thoughts down.
Yes, yes.
And seeing them on I would write them on my phone, but seeing them written down would really help me understand it. Do you know what I mean? So that was one tool that she gave me, was to write these things down. And then reading them back would be like a reflection of something. And that was one tool that would help. And, but also I started, I had to stop being happy-go-lucky Nathan all the time. I had to stop doing that. It was something she used to tell me off about. She used to say, like, you're doing it already. You've just come in. You're doing it already. You know, like, I can tell something's not right. So don't be him. Don't be that Nathan. Be the real one.
Be
you. So the being the real one rather than this mask I would put on all the time. And that was a big key thing for me, was stop pretending. And stop acting.
Yeah, interesting. I understand all of that. I think that's very well put. Well, I mean, the great news is that, you know, you did have the happy ending with Amanda, and you got married, and you and acquired a child. Absolutely brilliant. You went to live in bloody California, which is a lot different to Keithley. Or Wensleydale, which I thought that's where the cheese came from. But, you know, what's great is, you know, we sat down when we started to talk today. We talked about, you know, how you'd made the film The Fall, and Robert Bathurst had a part in it and was helping direct with you and all of that. But, you know, this is the end of this story, in a way, that you made that, and you made it. I don't want to sort of try and jazz this up, but you had two or three mates, you know, who weren't so fortunate, who were jockeys, and, you know, you made it really for them, I think, or you wanted to make it for them, didn't you, this film, about what had happened. And it strikes me, Nathan, that your story is fairly amazing, because it's like you're a sort of magnet. You were born like a magnet, and things stuck to you, but you battled along all this bloody time with all these things happening. And, you know, finally, it was, in a way, the love of a horse, an extraordinary horse, that got you going, and the death of a horse that nearly finished you off, but actually was your salvation.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, Claire would give me these tasks I was just saying earlier about, you know, writing these things down. And through that, this story manifested in my head, and I had to do something, you know. And believe me, Jeremy, I am not a writer. You know, my English school teacher would, you know, I think he's not around anymore because I didn't like him very much, but I remember him screaming at me, "Oryx, stop looking out the window, lad. You'll never amount to anything doing that," you know. So I remember, you know, I remember it stuck with me all my life, that, you know, it's that thing of, you know, stop daydreaming and, you know, so, you know, and like I say, I didn't find out till I was dyslexic till like 10 years ago. And I used to really struggle, you know, I still struggle now, you know, with,
but you've done great things.
It's through, you know, it's through ignorance or determination, however you want to put it, really. But, you know, when you walk, you know, when you're walking through mud, you can still see the dry land at the other side, can't you? You know what I mean? And like I said, I can always see the dry land on the other side.
Yeah.
Since going through this thing, and me writing this story was manifested from, you know, going through therapy, but also losing some key friends in, you know, in this world of horse racing. There was, you know, James Banks, who was a really good friend of mine, and at the time when I was really struggling, you know, even before my attempt on my life, he was sleeping on my couch at times. You know, he was a good friend with the lad that was renting a room off me. And on a Friday and Saturday night, he'd come back and end up sleeping on our couch. But we'd had some heavy conversations about where we were mentally, but we were still holding back on where we were where we were. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't honestly telling him where I was, and he wasn't honestly telling me where he was. And unfortunately, you know, James isn't with us anymore, you know, and I'm kind of, you know, not kicking myself, but I'm, you know, it'd be different now, you know, it'd be different if I have another James now, you know, talking to me. I'd be more honest, I think.
That's good.
Through this whole process of writing this short story, you know, of this car journey home, of disappointment, of a bad day at work. You know, we've all had them. It's just that this bad day at work for this jockey looks very, very differently to a lot of people's lives, because of the pressures that we spoke about earlier in, you know, in jockeys' lives. And, you know, this was kind of like not a tribute to them, because it's in honour of them, but basically it's a wake-up call to the people that have no idea what goes on with athletes, to, we just got to treat each other a little kinder.
Yeah.
We have to do this. We have to treat ourselves a little kinder, because, you know, the words and the, you know, we talked about the tweets and the messages earlier, you know, they have an effect on people, and they can sometimes be the tipping point of where somebody is mentally. Like I had the tipping point of, you know, many clouds leaving me, and, you know, leaving us, I should say. And that was my tipping point. But that's why this film was created. But, you know, thankfully, you know, writing this, you know, having Amanda, my wife, with me now, you know, it's been a great joy having her to kind of, her being a school teacher, ironically.
Yeah.
Not liking school teachers. Her helping me along with this journey, and just being a good communicator with me, because that's one thing I've learned from my first marriage, is just learning how to communicate better, stop holding things inside and being more open, really.
Yeah. But I think that's great. I really do. And, you know, the essential thing to me, having gone through one, two, excitements myself in life, you know, as you learn to be honest, and one is honest, and you are, and, you know, because it's a very easy to bullshit and not quite tell it how it is, but when people hear the truth, they hear it, and that's what helps, I think. That's why it's been tip top and totally tidy to have you on Shed Talks today. We have slightly overrun, so we are going to zoom on to the next section, and that section is one you've been looking forward to, which is life jackets. You know, I'm sure that if you said to me you needed to have a horse in there somewhere, That's fine. We'll just accept that.
Yeah, I think if anything, it's just the connection with, you know, with animals, I think. You know, all animals I seem to have a connection with, really. You know what I mean? It's, you know, I you know, if I see somebody walking a dog, I can't help myself but go and pat it or whatever it is. You know what I mean? There's just something about animals that are kind of more honest, you know what I mean, than humans, I suppose. And that's something that's always been, I've always been drawn to.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is with dogs, not cats, not like the one I've got, but most dogs give unconditional, you know, love, and that's what we like. And I somebody told me, or did I read this in a newspaper, a San Francisco Examiner, that you've got a Jack Russell called Maggie.
I have, and she is laid next to me right now in her little bed as we speak in. But she's hopefully her snoring isn't being picked up by the mic that I'm on right now. So she's snoring away there in her little bed.
Okay, so let's talk about your go-to films. Tell me.
Well, I mean, when you sent me the email, Jeremy, about this, I had to be super careful because I am the most annoying person when it comes to films. I drive all my friends crazy. I'll send them this text message, you have got to watch, and it'll be a film, because I just get over enthusiastic about films. And so it was very hard for me to pick a couple of films, but the two I've, well, one of them I've picked up to start with is and it's probably, it's one of my favorite films of all time, and I can just see a lot of me in it in some way. But I also like the way that this film's journey came about, more so, as well as the film. But the film is Good Will Hunting, which was written by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. And they were offered a silly amount of money not to be in it. And what I love about this story is they took inspiration from Sylvester Stallone when he was offered a serious amount of money not to be in Rocky, even though he wrote it. And I think there's something in that where it's, you know, you've created something, but they don't want you to be part of it. And they say, no, F you, I'm doing this. And it's that whole thing of a journey of just, you just got to, if you believe in yourself, just get it done. And that's one thing I love about that movie is obviously it's a great movie in itself, and the boys won the Oscar for it. And it's got one of my other favorite actors in it, you know, Robin Williams, who was just an absolute
hero about
of a guy. And love that guy. And and you know, it just had all the best elements in it. Really, what a great movie, you know.
Yeah, we like that. We like that a lot. And I want to talk about books, and I think that one that you have really, really highlighted, which is not that well known over here, I don't think, is Green Lights, Matthew McConaughey. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, look, I'll be honest with you, Jeremy, I am not a book reader. However, audiobooks are brilliant. And like I say, you know, when I'm having a tough day, I'll definitely put an audiobook on. But this one for me, because we all know Matthew McConaughey's just got one of the best voices in Hollywood, hasn't he? And he narrates this, and it's not an autobiography. He calls it a playbook, which I love. It's just little snippets of his life, and
it's him sort of anecdotes and thoughts, and this is what I think, and this happened to me when I was on the Route 66 when I bought a donut and I met this girl. Isn't it? I don't know.
It's absolutely fascinating, his story. It really is, because it's just not what you expect from a big Hollywood actor like him. You know, we always have these perceptions of people, don't we? And he definitely doesn't fit that mold of the big Hollywood actor with his life getting where he's got to, because, you know, his parents had a really tough time. They were married to each other three times. And divorced twice. I mean, it's just crazy the journey they had. They used to beat the living crap out of each other. It's such a weird journey that this guy has had, and it's definitely worth a listen to. My mum's an avid book reader. She absolutely loves reading books, but I did promise, I said to her, I said, please don't read it, listen to it, you've got to listen to it. Anyway, she's read it but is now listening to it, so she gets what I'm talking about when you've got to listen to his voice. But it's an absolute brilliant book, and it's one to one you can just dive into every now and again, and just get a little bit of an inspirational story from it.
Brilliant. Okay, all right, well, we'll put down all, on our website, we have all of your choices, and we've got them. But I want to go into music now, and I could have predicted this choice, I think. The Verve, A Bittersweet Symphony. How did I know? I just knew that that would be one of your choices. And I'm also seeing Working Class Hero, John Lennon. I can just see you with that one going, yes, thank you so much. And it's a great song, that, actually. I love the way John Lennon sings that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm obviously, yeah, it's very obvious the couple of picks I've picked up there, but music plays a huge part in my life. There's never a time when it's not on. In our house here, in the car, I hate silence. I need something to kind of take me away. And you know, music's been a huge soundtrack to my whole life, really. And it's a massive time machine for me, is music. You know, I grew up in the 90s, so you know, dance music was a huge part of me growing up. You know, I turned 16 in, you know, in 1991. You know, it was just as acid house had been around for a couple of years. Yeah. I mean, it hadn't really reached us in the you know, in the back in the backside of Yorkshire. You know what I mean? It, you know, it's very hard to get to any gigs or anything. But you know, all of a sudden there was this music that had no lyrics.
Yeah,
because I don't listen to lyrics anyway. Unless I'm feeling down, I get lyrics. But my wife's a big fan of lyrics. But normally it's the vibe of something. So, you know, any type of music can put me into a certain mood. But, you know, I love that era of the early 90s, you know, Future Sound of London, Orbital, you know, that them type of bands, you know, that were, you know, The Prodigy was a band that went to see, you know, 22 times, I think.
Really?
Yeah, it was a band I loved. Yeah, I remember it, you know, it wanted to make you kind of like take a sledgehammer to a car or something. Do you know what I mean? Not that I'm an aggressive person anyway, but it kind of made me want to do things, you know, more aggressively. Do you know what I mean? Whether it be, you know, riding your bike or whatever it may be. Do you know what I mean? It was that type of music, yeah. Really. And, you know, that type of stuff can really, really uplift me, I think. But certain classical music can really kind of mellow me out and put me into a, not a dark space, but it can definitely put me into a headspace I wouldn't be, you know, listening to, you know, Oasis, let's say, you know. So it's an interesting thing, music, for me. It paints pictures in my head, and which comes in really well for my job when I'm, you know, when we're making a commercial. What type of music should this feel like? Because it makes you feel a certain way, you know. Sound is as important as what you're looking at, I think.
Yeah, well, brilliant. I like hearing all that. I mean.
But however, you know, funny enough, you mentioned earlier, you know, The Verve and In Bittersweet Symphony being my one of my favourite songs. And the reason it is one of my favourite songs, and I'm just saying, I don't, you know, kind of contradicting myself, saying I don't like lyrics, but I just don't search for lyrics too much. But one lyric that really stands out for me in that song is, you know, I need to hear some sounds that recognise the pain in me. Do you know what I mean? When Richard Ashcroft sings that, like, I know what he's saying.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. It's that like song that kind of like hits your soul, you know. And you know, I think he's just a great songwriter. And that album Urban Hymns, when it came out, was something that was on repeat a lot, you know. I love that.
Yeah. So golf and hiking, quite important.
Yes, golf and hiking. I mean, they're both similar. One's a walk, and the other one ruins a good walk, as some people tell me. So the thing about golf for me is, it's two things. It's a great way of killing 4 hours. If you don't seem to have 4 hours these days, but one thing, it kind of concentrated your mind and you were doing something physical. You know, not a lot of people think golf is a physical game, but it really is. And also it just, it kind of makes you concentrate on something, you know, like you're concentrating on a shot, and it helps you helps you get away from the normal days.
It's a form of meditation.
That's it, yeah. No, a bad day's golf's better than a good day's work sometimes, I think, you know. Especially with the people that you're around. And I've got some good mates that love a game of golf, and we have a game, and, you know, there's a lot of good conversations go on in a game of golf. You get to know somebody in 4 hours, you know, that you probably wouldn't know, you know, and I think that's good. That's a good thing, and they can get to know you, you can get to know them.
All right. Well, you know, we're going to have to get you to come back and to talk more about this. So I'm going to conclude this by saying two different things to you. One, you know, there was a Scottish doctor called Dr. McTavish who, when asked, "What do you need to be happy?" He said, "Oh, indeed," because it was in 1870. He spoke like that. He said, "Oh, indeed, you need three things. You need something to do, someone to love, and something to hope for. Would you concur with that?"
Absolutely. I think that's something you should really live by. And, you know, I've been very lucky to, you know, to find all three of those things, really. You know, not everybody has those. But I think if you search for it, you can find it in something, you know. And but I'm very lucky that I've found all three of those things.
That's brilliant. Lastly, okay, this is what we say. You know, if a young person, you know, aged, I don't know, 15, 16, 17, came along and said, "Nathan, you know, I'm having a really bad time, and, you know, I just don't think I'm going to amount to anything, and oh, I don't know, and I'm feeling really depressed, and, you know, this and that." What would you say? What advice would you give?
I mean, for me, it's when you're that age, you want everything to happen straight away. And it's, you know, it's just to have some patience and don't be in a rush. Because I remember me being at that age, being in such a hurry to find my place in the world or be successful in something. Because, you know, especially in the day and age now where, you know, everybody's living their best life on the internet, you know, whether it be through Instagram, Facebook, no one's putting their problems on there. They're putting all the best things on there for us all to be reflecting on. And so it's even much harder now. So I think for me is, you know, be true to yourself, but also just don't be in such a rush. You can get caught up in all that of wanting it to happen yesterday. And, you know, just try and take the time and take it all in. And, you know, just try and have a clear horizon, really. That's the only bit of advice I can give, because that was definitely me when I was 15, 16. I was just in a rush to get to where I needed to be. And that can cause some hard issues for you, I think.
Yeah. Tragically, Nathan, we have come to the end of this wonderful edition of Shed Talks. And I've really enjoyed it. You are a top rocker of the highest order. You may not know that, but you are. And, you know, when I next come to take over California, I shall be coming to see you. And I hope, anyway. But it's really been great. Thank you so much. Tip top and totally tidy.
Well, thank you for having me on, Jeremy. It's been a pleasure to, you know, talk through this. And it's funny enough, you know, like we were chatting earlier, you know, communicating with each other is definitely a key thing, and this has been very therapeutic for me just today, just chatting about you know, my journey getting here. And you know, I've really enjoyed it, and thank you for having me on.
Brilliant. Okay, until the next time, goodbye from Wincanton to California. And now it gives me great pleasure to reunite with our top, top, top psychotherapist, Karen Cowan. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
Well, much the better for speaking to you. And here we are again, and it's November. My goodness me, and we're on episode 9, and, you know, the beat keeps going.
Yes.
So, Nathan Horrocks, what an episode. What an extraordinary story, and I'm so pleased to have got Nathan to come and talk to us. It seemed to me that he almost had a jigsaw, of different jigsaw pieces of traumatic things that had happened along the way. What do you think? I mean, what was your impression of that?
Well, my impression was that Nathan's come out of a lot, and he's had the full gamut of experiences, as you said, you know, from feeling suicidal, to having dyslexia, to being bullied at school, to moving house, to his mother leaving home, to having two dead siblings.
Incredible.
A broken marriage.
Yeah.
And he's clearly, you know, again, a great survivor. And one of the things that I really thought was that I'm imagining that his dad must have been quite some guy, because there must have been some kind of steadiness in Nathan's very difficult life, for Nathan to turn out so jolly nice and to have managed to do so well. And obviously Nathan kept the lid on everything for years and years.
Yes. I don't know, I mean, about his father, because he didn't really say, but what he did say was that, you know, when his sister had anorexia and was very, very ill, and I thought it was terribly honest. You know, he said, I was so angry with her, you know, for upsetting my father, you know, because it was, you know, my father had such a terrible time, you know, losing his first daughter. And now what was she going to, you know, I thought, gosh, that was very honest.
Yes, he sounds a very, very sort of honest and kind person. And that's something I think that often happens with the siblings of children or young people with mental illnesses, particularly anorexia, which seems so much as if it's in your own control, when of course it isn't. So to a young boy, it must have seemed as if, why don't you just eat? Why are you putting Dad through this?
Yes. Yeah, good point.
And it must have felt so really, really difficult. And it struck me a lot when he talked about the suicide attempt, that one of the things he thought was, I can't do this to my parents because they've already lost two children.
Yes.
So he was kind of, he seems to have some kind of innate goodness in him from somewhere, which shines through.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think the you know, as you just said, I mean, what is fascinating about his story is, you know, the business with the horse Many Clouds. I mean, how he met this horse in a top trainer's Oliver Sherwood stables, and he was just he'd finished being a jockey, but he was just he needed a connection with a horse, and he got this one with this huge horse that was terribly nervous and difficult. And he helped the horse, and, you know, and they got a bond going, and extraordinary over a period of a year and a half, I think.
Yes, it felt like they helped each other.
Yes.
One of the things that he also lived through, which must have been mentally very difficult, was having to starve himself to be a jockey.
Oh, yes.
And then, but his sister was also starving herself as part of an illness. And just to bring us back to when the horse died, that would be just one of the many things that I think the death of the beautiful horse blew the lid off, kind of thing. And he really couldn't cope anymore. Yes.
Yes. What seemed to be very clear from talking to Nathan was that what saved his bacon totally was meeting a therapist and really spending a long period of time, which I think for him was a year and a half. I mean, talk us through that, because that's pretty well what you do.
Well, I think you know, not blowing the profession's trumpet, but clearly therapy was very helpful for Nathan. And also he did the classic thing, which was really good, and I'm glad he had the strength to do it, of leaving a therapist that he didn't feel right with, because a lot of therapy is actually about the relationship with the therapist and yourself, and that is one of the agents of change in a way, because you build
trust.
It's trust and building a relationship of unconditional positive regard and somebody hearing your truth,
yes,
and sticking with you, and sometimes things that you might be ashamed of.
Yes.
So it really kind of needs to be the right person, but also just letting go of some emotions, learning to cope with emotions, which you may have suppressed for years in order to survive, and learning to cope with that, and learning different techniques of how to cope with yourself, getting to know yourself, understanding your relationships with other people,
yes,
accepting yourself. There's so many things that go on in the conversation of therapy that in the right setting are so, so helpful for people. Besides anything else, it's a safe space to talk about things that maybe you feel you can't talk to anyone about.
Yes, and that safety is really important. I understand that. Just on that therapist counselling note, if somebody is listening to this, Karen, who goes, oh my God, you know, my son, my husband, my wife, you know, whoever, my cousin, really could do with this, what's their best first steps? I mean, is there something they look at on the internet or...?
You know, it depends on your financial situation. You may want to speak to your GP and try. It's very hard in the NHS to get a referral to perhaps your local talking space service, which is a sort of CBT service that most trusts use, or to a national health psychologist. Alternatively, if you can afford to go privately, the places to look are the British Psychological Society,
right,
of which I'm a member, the UKCP, which is the Council of Psychotherapists, and the BABCP, which is Cognitive Therapists.
Okay. And I mean, do you just, is it sort of, not exactly potluck, but I mean, or is there, or are there sort of categories of specialists, you know?
There's lots of different categories. The sort of zeitgeist, very much the zeitgeist at the moment within the NHS, remains cognitive behavioural therapy, which, you know, can go quite deeply, but is very much about how emotions, behaviours, physical symptoms and thoughts link together, and intervening at that level, challenging difficult thoughts, finding ways of coping with anxiety.
Yeah. And it does help a lot of people, doesn't it? I mean,
oh yes, people say it's an enormous relief. I mean, many people haven't talked about anything all their lives, and they feel better very fast. But it isn't a magic bullet. It's not going to cure everything that's ever happened to you. But it's going to give you a space to vent your feelings, to understand things. And I sometimes say, for example, in the case of trauma, it's that what perhaps has always been an open sore on your leg,
yes,
reminding you of what's happened, therapy can help it become a scar which doesn't hurt but is there. You know, it's not going to take away everything.
Yeah.
But it's going to give you a lot of ways of coping and hopefully a bit of inner calm.
I think that's really, I mean, it's not a very nice image, but it is actually just, you know, yeah, it's really well put actually. And that's easy. I think that's easier for people to understand who don't know anything about this subject. Well, I think we raise a glass to Nathan Horrocks, don't we, in...
Yes, we do. What a wonderful man.
He's great. And we're backing you, Nathan, and your new wife and your stepdaughter and your, you know, very groovy film company. And, I mean, just great. And thank you for being our guest today. And thank you, Karen, for being a tip-top person as ever. Thanks to everybody, and it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Karen.
Goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you to Stuart Bagshaw, our top engineer editor. Thank you to B. Brooke, our top administrator, production manager. Thank you to Karen Cowan, our top psychologist. If you want to find out more about Shed Talks, visit our website, jeremythomastalks.co.uk. Please sign up to the newsletter. If you want to write to us or find out anything about anybody or contact anyone on the show, inquiries at jeremythomastalks.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook at Shed Talks, Shed Talks Twitter at JT Shed Talks, Instagram - Jeremy Thomas Talks. So it's all been tip top and totally tidy. Stay safe, be groovy. Please sign up, support, and share this. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.